Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And good afternoon, and welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. I'm Eric Ryder, audio engineer and producer for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. We've got a brand new show for you today. Vicki is still in England, but she recently sat down with a few authors that have some great advice on how to be more successful in life. Coming up today, Vicki will talk to, she'll be talking to Heather Hunter, about the job seeker's mental tug of war. Now, psychotherapist Heather M. Hunter believes that the countermeasure to the slide in confidence that you get when you get rejections when you're looking for a new job is to recognize the pattern and stay a step ahead. Stay tuned for that. That's coming up soon. Also, Vicki will be talking to co-author of The Four Disciplines of Execution, Chris McChesney. McChesney is a leadership consultant, executive advisor, and speaker for the Franklin Covey Speakers Bureau. But first, many assume creativity is an asset one is born with and it can't be learned. In her new book, Ingenious, executive director of Stanford Technology Venture Program and international bestseller Tina Seelig sets out to prove that theory wrong. With this book, the award-winning professor offers readers a practical guide to improve creativity, foster innovation, and bring an entrepreneurial mindset to all aspects of life. She demonstrates how companies such as Twitter, Apple, Facebook, and even Amazon use creative thinking to go from being modest startups to global icons. Seelig holds a PhD in neuroscience, and in 2009, she was awarded the highly prestigious Gordon Prize for her innovative work in technology, engineering, and education. Vicki recently sat down with Tina Seelig, and here's that conversation now.
Well, I want to welcome Tina Seelig to the show today. Thank you so much for being with us. This is a really terrific book you've written. I'm guessing you've got rave reviews about it.
Well, it just came out a couple days ago, and I'm really delighted by the early responses.
So it's called Ingenious, as I said in the introduction, a crash course on creativity. Certainly, I work in the creative field. It certainly made me look at things very, very differently. And I'm assuming nobody can actually read this without feeling the same kind of having the same kind of experience. But I want to begin, Tina, for the purposes of our show today, by defining the word creativity, because it seems many companies give a lot of lip service to the word creative and creativity, but it's often misapplied. How, define it for the purposes of your book.
Yeah, you know, I use the word creativity in a really simple way. It's basically coming up with really fresh and interesting ideas. One of the problems I think you're hitting against is that most people come up with incremental solutions that really aren't very innovative, and they think they're being creative. And so what I'm trying to do is help people figure out how do you get beyond the first right answer, beyond the second, third, fourth, and end up coming up with really innovative solutions to all the problems that come your way.
Right. And you say that many people do assume creativity is an asset we're born with. I've heard and worked with people who've said, oh, I'm just not creative. You say that's absolutely not true.
Of course it's not true. I mean, if you think about it, every single sentence that we utter is, on some level, a creative effort, right? Nobody has given us a recipe. We're not robots with just a program responses. We are generating new ideas and new responses to the world every minute. And so we need to figure out how to unleash that in all parts of our lives.
Right. You say that, and this is very true, something I hadn't thought of before, and of course that's what this book is all about, is getting people to think differently. But, you know, as young kids, we're taught to discover. We're not too often taught to invent.
Yeah, this is a really important point, and it was a revelation that I had just recently, is that, you know, I'm a scientist by training, and I'm actually a neurophysiologist, and I spent, you know, my life learning the scientific method. And the scientific method, you know, that we are introduced to when we're young children is, you know, teaches us how to discover how things work. But we need an equally powerful methodology for how to invent things. And most people think of the process of invention as being some mysterious process, but it's really not. There are tools, techniques, and conditions that we really can leverage in order to really come up with really inventive new ideas.
Mm. And you just raised a good point. You've spent most of your life in science. You've studied science. You have a PhD in neuroscience. What led you into creativity and teaching this creative class at Stanford, which then led to this book?
Yeah, so it's actually interesting. I was drawn initially to neuroscience, which I studied both as an undergrad and as a PhD student, because I really was curious about how our brain generates new ideas. I kind of joke that when I finished my PhD, I realized we really don't know how the brain works. They could have saved me a lot of time if they had told me that earlier. I then decided to look at creativity, you know, in the wild, look at creativity in the entrepreneurial setting. And my day job is essentially running the Entrepreneurship Center at Stanford School of Engineering, where I work with students and companies bringing, you know, ideas to life. And one of the most fun things I get to do is teach this class on creativity. And I've been doing that for a dozen years, and this book captures basically everything I know about creativity.
Right, right. So let's talk a little bit about this class then, and let's talk about your book, because I believe you begin every class with an exercise. Talk to us about the kind of exercises that you begin every class with, if you would.
Yeah, so we actually start every class with a warm-up exercise to get everybody in the right frame of mind. And some of them, you know, are actually quite provocative, and they really are designed to unlock some really interesting new ways of looking at the world. You might have read a story in the book about the fact that, you know, I'll walk into the class the first day and say, listen, you know, the students all have name tags on. I'll say, well, I hate name tags. Really, I do. You know, first of all, they're stuck to your clothes, often leaving adhesive there. They're hard to read. They don't have the information I really want to know about you. And they're often hanging around the wearer's, you know, belt buckle, which is awkward, right?
Right.
I say, okay, you know, can you go back and redesign name tags? And they go back and come back with a bunch of interesting solutions and new name tags that are pinned to their shirts and have more information. They're easier to read. And I say, okay, great. That was the first step. But why do we use name tags in the first place? We use name tags because we need them to solve a really important social problem, which is, you know, we need an introduction device. We need a way to stimulate conversations between people who don't know each other. Oh, that's interesting. How might we do that if we don't use name tags? And so by reframing problems, you end up opening up the whole landscape of possible solutions.
Okay, I'm going to stop just a second there. I wonder if you could just say that last sentence again. There was a lot of static coming over the phone.
Yeah, there was. I don't know. I'm on a landline, so I don't know what the problem is. But anyway, I'm just going to say, by reframing problems, you open up the landscape of possible solutions.
Great, thank you. What I wanted to talk a little bit about is framing and reframing, because obviously the crux of your book really focuses around framing and reframing. So I wonder if you'd talk to us about what you mean by framing, first of all, and then we can talk about reframing.
Right. The framing is essentially what are the questions that you're asking. And if you don't ask the right question in the first place, you're not going to get really interesting answers. I mean, let me give you just a couple of really simple examples. And if I say, how do I plan a birthday party for you? I'm going to get a really different answer than if I say, how can I create the most interesting celebration for your birthday? Right?
Yeah, definitely.
Just asking it differently, you come up with different solutions. For example, I could say, will you build me a bridge? And you could go off and design and build me a bridge. But you might ask, wow, why do you need a bridge in the first place? And you'd say, well, gee, I've got to get across this river or this lake. there are certainly a lot more solutions to that problem than there are, you know, than just building a bridge. So the way you ask the question dramatically changes the way you see the results, and so you need to practice framing and reframing the question in the same way that a photographer might reframe a picture. You know, are you, when you're in a scene, are you going to take a picture of the entire landscape, or are you going to take a picture of just, you know, one small flower in front of your feet?
Yeah, this is interesting because you've got to have a certain amount of creativity and start unleashing that early on to even begin to reframe those questions, right? Because we get in the habit of asking those same old questions.
Exactly. And so you have to practice. In fact, Albert Einstein is quoted as saying, if I had a daunting problem to solve, I had 1 hour to solve it, and my life depended upon it, I would spend the first 55 minutes framing the problem.
Oh, and yeah, interesting. I remember reading that. Yeah, I remember reading that. But I've always found with projects, the work you put up front pays off in the end. So same thing there. So once we've changed our perspective, you talk about, you give a lot of really great examples in the book and share some really good ideas. This is what I wanted to talk about right now. Looking above eye level, you say that, you know, yes, of course, we're intrinsically creative. Some people are, but born that way. But anyone can learn it with these tools. And one of those tools is look above eye level. So talk to us about that.
Well, it actually is broader than that. I mean, that's one example, but essentially paying attention to the world around you. Your knowledge about the world is the toolbox for your imagination. So the more you know, the more you have to work with. And so one of the ways to do that is to really extract as much value from just things in your own environment. We often just go through life with blinders on, not paying attention to the things that are really going to help us identify opportunities, identify interesting challenges, and identify, you know, answers to problems that we're trying to solve.
Yeah. And use metaphors, you say, the approach to tackling crime as a virus instead of a monster. I mean, these are all just great examples, I think, of getting us to think differently.
Exactly. In fact, metaphors are a terrific way to really unleash your creativity because metaphors really give you a way to, again, reframe the problem. If I say, crime is like a monster in our community, we're going to come up with really different types of solutions than if we say crime is like a virus in our community, or crime is like someone tracking mud into the house. So by giving you, you know, coming up with interesting metaphors, you again unleash different types of solutions to different problems.
Mm. And embracing failure. Why is it so important for us to embrace failure when we're trying to be creative?
Yeah, people say this all the time, and I think there's actually a problem with our vocabulary. As a scientist, when I do an experiment and it doesn't work out as I expected, I don't call it a failure. I call it data. And we make a mistake in our lives of thinking that when things turn out differently than we expected, that we consider those failures. Yes, they're disappointments often, but if you look at it as data, then what you end up with is a much better opportunity to learn from it. If you think about it, you know, no child walks or talks or gets on a bicycle the first time without failing, without having to try again and again and again. Why do we assume that adults who are tackling really challenging problems that don't have a right answer are going to do it the first time correctly? And so we have to embrace the process of trial and error, of failing fast and frequently, of trying lots of things and keeping what works.
Yeah, I agree. I think we'd be a lot more productive and creative and a lot less afraid to try new things.
Yes, and I think that's a good point. You need to be able to take some risks, and that it is, if you don't take some risks, you know, and take the chance that something won't work out, you're probably never going to do anything interesting.
Mm. Well, my guest in this segment is Tina Seelig. Her book is called Ingenious, A Crash Course on Creativity. And it is a really, not just a great read, but it is very, very inspirational. I want to talk about something I love to do, Tina, and that is brainstorming. And I loved how you put this together in the book. Because I find myself, it's hard for me to brainstorm sitting around a desk. I like to get up and move. And this is exactly what you talk about in the book. So share some points on brainstorming, if you would.
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked this because most people think that brainstorming is easy, and brainstorming is actually really complicated. Just as I can give you the rules for chess or the rules for baseball, and they seem pretty simple, it doesn't mean that you can play, right? It's actually a skill that has to be mastered. There are some basic things about brainstorming that most of us know, you know, generate lots of ideas, build on ideas, there are no bad ideas. But actually, there are many other things that come into play if you want a successful brainstorming session. And as you bring up, moving around, brainstorming needs to be done standing up. If you have people sitting around a table, there is a completely different energy than if you're standing up. It allows for people to move around. It allows for much more fluid generation of ideas. I invite all your listeners to try this. Just do an experiment of standing up versus sitting down while you're brainstorming. But there's so many other variables that are important. The physical space, who's in the room, all the sort of props you have there. You have to really look at all the things that are affecting the way you're thinking and behaving, and they actually have a very big impact on the types of ideas you generate.
Yeah. You also, in the Table Kingdom chapter, I think, mentioned how when people were sent to sit at tables versus sent to sit at chairs, they stayed isolated at their table versus the people with the chairs just grouped them all together and became more of a cohesive team.
Exactly. Well, this was actually a surprise for me. I was doing a simulation exercise in my class, and I had so many students that I broke the class into two ecosystems, two groups to work on this exercise. And to distinguish them, I put one side of the class, the students sitting at tables with no chairs, and the other side of the class had chairs but no tables. And it was just sort of so we could have, you know, two students that would distinguish themselves.
Right.
Well, I've now run this exercise many times, and the results are completely consistent. When you have tables, you react completely differently than if you're sitting at chairs. The people in the chairs, all of a sudden, were not anchored by their tables. They rearranged the chairs, and all of a sudden, the entire group on that side of the room was collaborating and working together, whereas the people who were sitting at the individual tables anchored their projects on those tables. It completely changed the entire dynamic. The students thought that they were in control of the strategies they were using to play this game, but really the space had determined their strategy. This is actually extremely important and very profound. When we walk into a space, the space dictates how we behave, and we have to pay attention to that if we want people to be creative.
Yeah, I actually was, I felt validated when I read that because I'm one of those people who likes the space to be a certain way. And I, like, for example, if I'm brainstorming, I often take my stuff out and go, you know, out to the beach or a park and do it outdoors. But so many people say, oh, they can work anywhere. But I really do think it makes such a huge difference. And the studies and exercises in your book just proved exactly that.
Well, in fact, you know, space has such a big effect on us that it can be demonstrated even in healthcare. There are studies that have been done that show that patients who are in hospitals, who are recovering from surgery, who are looking out the window at a bucolic scene of trees and nature, recover more quickly, need less pain medication, and have fewer, you know, complications than those people who are looking out, you know, at another building. So space is incredibly powerful effect on us, and we just often don't pay attention to that.
Mm. So I want to talk a little about creative procrastination, because you say this is something you embrace, certainly something I've embraced, but talk to us a little bit about that, if you would.
Yeah, well, it's a little bit, I mean, I was being a little bit funny.
Right.
But it is true. We need to think about how constraints of all different types affect our creativity. Now, constraints can come in the form of time, as in procrastination. You know, you sort of wait until the last minute and then you're very motivated to get things done. It can come in terms of space, the number of people, the amount of money you have. And most people don't take that into account. For example, one of the best ways to come up with creative ideas when you're trying to solve a problem is imagine you had different constraints. You know, what if I were doing this with no money at all? What if I was doing this for young kids? What if I was doing this on the moon? So by framing the problem and adding different constraints, you end up coming up with really different outcomes. And I was talking about the fact that, you know, I ended up with my book, this new book, not working on it at the beginning. I think I was actually working on it in the back of my mind, but I ended up with much less time than I thought to write it, and that pressure ended up causing a tremendous amount of energy to be focused on the project.
Yeah, I just call it my simmering period. My ideas are simmering subconsciously, and they'll suddenly start boiling over, which does happen. So we're right at the end of our segment. I could talk to you for hours about this book. It was really interesting. But I often ask guests when I end a segment what they wish they'd known 20 years ago. And since you wrote a book called What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20, what's the number one thing you wish you'd known back then?
Yeah, the theme of that book, What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20, is all about how to make things happen. If this book, the new book, Ingenious, is all about creativity, that book is all about entrepreneurship and having an entrepreneurial mindset. And one of the key things is being able to challenge assumptions, to break the rules, to make your own luck, and how to make things happen.
Well, I appreciate you being with us. Final thought you'd like to leave Alice's with today, Tina?
Well, one of the things that we didn't get a chance to talk about is the fact that in Ingenious, I present a model that I've created called the Innovation Engine that actually looks at how all the factors that affect creativity are interrelated. The things that happen in you that are your internal combustion engine for creativity and the things in the outside world that affect your ability to generate new ideas and how they're actually completely interrelated and you can't look at any one piece in isolation.
Right. And if we understand that and understand the tools you've supplied in there, we have no reason not to be creative.
Yes.
Thank you so much for being with us. Tina Seelig is my guest. Her great new book is called Ingenious, A Crash Course on Creativity.
And you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Again, Vicki's guest was Tina Seelig. And you can find out more about her just by checking out, just type in Google, Tina Seelig. Her last name is spelled S-E-E-L-I-G. Or for your Bing fans out there, you could type it into Bing as well. There is a lot of information about Tina online. We are coming back with another Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair interview. Vicki recently sat down with Heather Hunter, and we'll be bringing you that right after these words. Stay tuned.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in. Providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
You're listening to the refreshingly different Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Vicky is in England, in her home country, again this week. But we are bringing you several conversations that Vicky recently recorded. And our next guest is Heather M. Hunter. Heather describes herself as a wellness intuitive and a holistic psychotherapist. And you can find out more about her by checking out her website, heathermhunter.com. Now, all it takes is a few rejections and the confidence and energy you began your job hunt with can plummet. Once that self-doubt sits in, it becomes increasingly difficult to remain ambitious about seeking gainful employment. Psychotherapist Heather M. Hunter believes the countermeasure to that slide is to recognize the pattern and stay a step ahead. If you know how the grind of a job hunt can affect you, you can prepare yourself mentally, which in the end can get you hired, she notes. Hunter holds a degree in psychology and specializes in well-being as a lifestyle strategist, where she counsels clients on all aspects of life, including career.
Well, Heather, I want to welcome you to the show, first of all. We're going to talk about the job seeker's mental tug of war. And we're going to talk in particular about a Wall Street Journal study or a Wall Street Journal report about a study that found job seekers' mental health improves during the first 3 months of unemployment. So were you surprised when you read that study?
Hi, Vicky. No, I really wasn't that surprised at that portion of it. In fact, it sort of made me smile because as far as that portion of the study, I think that as human beings, we can be very resilient. And I think that when someone loses a job, they're very quick to say, you know, of course they take the hit because that's been noted in there. There is a drop in mood, but then they bounce back and they say, well, you know, I'm going to find something better. There must be something better for me out there. They're very good. We are very good at trying to focus on the positive in something like that, at least in the beginning. Mm-hmm. We feel that maybe there's something better for us out there. You know what? I didn't really like that job that much anyway.
Right.
And then as we continue the search, we start to take it more personally, our lack of finding a job. We start to say, you know, am I really that bad? Am I not qualified? Am I doing something weird in my interviews? And we really make it so personal and so about us. But we can see by looking at the statistics that, you know, more and more of us are struggling to find work. So there's a lot more going on in our society. But what happens is we really internalize the rejection, and we really need to catch ourselves and not do that.
Right. So by recognizing, I mean, I think this is great that you're talking about this, because by recognizing, okay, we're going to have a little down period and then we're probably going to feel much better and then we're going to hit this down period again, we can try and preempt that and do something about it.
Right.
So
well,
self-doubt, I think, you know, having talked with people who've lost their jobs, self-doubt is something that constantly creeps in with people. How do they counteract that?
Well, again, being aware of it, that it's not just about you, is really, really important. And I think also what happens is the job search becomes, of course, your job. And it's not a very fulfilling one. And it takes an awful lot of our time and energy, and then you're getting a pile up of rejection. And so obviously it's very upsetting, and it's hard not to internalize that. But what we need to be doing with our lives is finding purpose in the moment. So besides searching for a job, where else can we be very present and very engaged in our lives? There's more to our lives than a job search, and there's certainly more to our lives than a job, although obviously it's very important for financial reasons. But, you know, what's going on at home? I mean, you can really use some of this time to maybe enhance relationships with your family members, maybe take on a hobby or a project that you've put aside that would be very personally fulfilling and enriching. And you never know, you could be plumping up your resume as you do these other kinds of jobs, or even volunteer work. That's another one that, yes, it takes time, and so does your job search, but if you find yourself volunteering at something you find fulfilling, now you are rewarding yourself, you're building yourself up, you feel useful, which is very important. We need to feel useful.
Right.
And you're giving back, and probably, depending on what you're doing, you're building up your resume still. So that's, you know, three-pronged approach to feeling better and being productive. And that's what we need, is we need to feel productive and purposeful in our lives. And so when we feel like we're waiting for a job to just come to us, that's a very helpless feeling. And it's depressing.
Yeah, and self-perpetuating is just one of those cycles that's going to get us deeper and deeper down, isn't it?
Absolutely. And then what happens, too, is you tend, when you do get that interview, folks will tend to pull that sort of downer feeling into the interview, and we don't want that there. And what happens, and it really does happen, is in trying to be real with your interviewer, which is a great thing to be, by the way, but you need to discern what you're going to share and not share. So really your interviewer doesn't need to hear about how hard it's been to find a job. We know that. They know that, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so you really have to stay positive and make that eye contact. Be inspiring, because they, more important than your skills even, is that you're bringing an energy that they want to have around them, that they want to have around their company or organization. So no fantastic skill set is going to overpower, you know, a depressed or dejected demeanor.
Yeah, I think it must be, it's probably very hard to, you know, when somebody's like getting really low on money and they're just at a point where I'm desperate to get this job, how do they stop that emanating? The, you know, there's that expression about the stink of desperation. And I think it's very hard for people not to give that off, even though they're trying not to.
Well, something that's amazing about life and our world, from my perspective, is that we can constantly recreate our reality, so to speak. So you may not have a job today, but you do not know that tomorrow you won't be getting that phone call. So you have to focus on the good that could happen more than you're focusing on the negative going on right now. This is where I encourage you to be future focused and picture yourself in that job and know that it's coming. Feel that it's coming. And you need to bring that energy into every interview, because obviously you're sabotaging yourself if you're bringing the negative energy in.
Mm. How do you think, in your experience, when you've talked with people, how does a potential employer look at somebody when they've been unemployed for 6 months? Do you think they're looking at them differently than somebody who's in a job or somebody who's been out of work for a month?
Well, I've also been on that end. I've been an interviewer in the past. So one of the things that I know that they look at is, what are you doing with your time? So, you know, and for your own well-being, you should be productive with your time. You should be. And it's not that they're going to think less of you by saying, well, I'm a stay-at-home mom. That's very important. But, you know, if you're a college grad, what are you doing? You know, are you taking other work? Are you, you know, sitting on the sofa? I mean, be ready with an answer of what you're doing and do something for your own sake. Be doing something. It's a great opportunity to maybe hone some other skills. And that's what the interviewers want to see, that you're making use out of your life.
Right, right. And another important thing, I know my parents raised all of us to be, they always said, be yourself. It doesn't matter what the situation, be yourself, because, you know, if you're not, you'll ultimately get found out. And, you know, when we're interviewing, I think it's important for people to be themselves. And that's actually covered in this Wall Street Journal article,
yes,
too.
And it is extremely important. And really, recruiters, your interviewers, they're in that position because they like people, they're good with people, and they can read people. So there, you know, there's definitely the BS detector. So to
right, right, right.
That's not, you know, even if you don't feel that confident maybe about your, let your personality, let your sincerity win the interviewer over, because it will. Because if they see you as trainable, then maybe they don't care that you don't have the perfect skill set. They want you to be an energy that's positive, that's has potential. Potential is a wonderful thing. You know, if you're trainable and, you know, easygoing and agreeable, then they're going to like that about you.
Yes. Yeah. I know when I was a hiring manager for many years, I always looked for, is there a light on at home? Because I can train the rest.
Right. Really important.
Yeah, and what if somebody, you know, is getting these constant rejections? You know, I always used to tell people it's okay to call back if you, you know, want to discuss the interview. But I think if people call back and ask for feedback, that's probably one of the best things they can do. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think that can be useful, but, you know, don't beat yourself up if the feedback is, you know, not what you were hoping to hear. I think it's really important to tell yourself that maybe it's just not time yet. I know it's crazy, and this is where we almost have to kind of have a faith about the way our life is flowing. Maybe I need to be more involved in something else needs my attention right now within myself, maybe at home, and you really have to tell yourself maybe it's just not time, and it's really important that you realize you're much more than these rejections. You're more than what happens to you in your life.
Absolutely. Well, we're almost at the end of our segment. I think this is great advice. Final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with, Heather?
Well, of course, stay positive. but it's really true. And just know that when it's right, you will find your niche. You know, be creative in your job search, too. You know, and think about highlighting other positive attributes that you have, not just your degree and not just one or two specific skills. But if you want to send an email and ask some questions, I do actually offer, this has been requested of me, to do some interview coaching. So I do that in my practice, and I can do it over the phone or even Skype. So
awesome.
You can visit my website, which is heathermhunter.com, www.heathermhunter.com.
Excellent. Well, heathermhunter.com, psychotherapist and life strategist, I thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Vicki. It's been a pleasure.
And again, her website is heathermhunter.com. It's heathermhunter.com, spelled just like it sounds. Stay tuned to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Vicki is going to be bringing us another conversation. This time she'll be talking to co-author of the book, The Four Disciplines of Execution, Chris McChesney. That's coming up right after the break here on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM. Stay tuned.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
If you want to reach a large audience of like-minded people, people with integrity, people who strive to live well and live strong, let Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair shine a spotlight on your message. Tell us about your business, product, service, or event, and we'll help you craft your message and promote your good work. Email Vicki at conversationslive.net or call 425-269-4772. That's 425-269-4772. 4772.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW-IMHO. Copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
Tune in to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, June 4th at 12 noon Pacific. How would you feel if you found out the government has taken away your right to full disclosure on what you eat and where it comes from? That's reality in Iowa, and several other states may soon follow. Join Vicki on June 4th as she welcomes one of the country's foremost experts on the meatpacking and processing industry for an inside look at how large corporations have achieved such power and what can be done about it. Don't miss a single episode of Conversations Live every Monday at noon Pacific, right here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Lewis and Clark would be proud. We're exploring new territory on the air every day, right here on Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
And this is Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Eric Ryder here with you, filling in for Vicki St. Clair. But we are presenting several conversations that Vicki recently had with some authors that hope to help make you more successful. Now, whether you're a project coordinator, lead a small sales team, run a Fortune 500 company, or simply want to create better results in your personal life, you can benefit from the four disciplines of execution. Co-author Chris McChesney believes that these disciplines represent a major breakthrough in how to move teams, organizations, and individuals forward and profoundly change the way you approach your goals. McChesney is a leadership consultant, executive advisor, and speaker for Franklin Covey Speakers Bureau, he's been with them for 20 years. And now, Vicki's conversation with Chris McChesney.
So, Chris, the premise of this work, the four disciplines of execution, or 4DX, as you call it, is that we fail in our strategy. We fail not in our strategy, but in our execution. And I certainly have seen that happen many, many times. Some great ideas are put together, great strategies developed around those ideas, and then things fall totally flat in execution. Why do you see that happening so often?
Well, it's interesting. It's almost, I think, in our wiring as people. You know, we're human beings are sort of wired for novelty and the new idea. And that's all very sexy. And you know, how many times do you hear people say, I'm kind of the idea man or the, you know,
right.
the idea woman? And yet some of the things associated with execution, they're not so intuitive for us. And we also tend to take them for granted as well.
Right. Now, one of the things that you talk about right in the beginning is the importance of focus. And I think it's fairly well known that Apple, it's been attributed to be one of the most focused companies around. Instead of, you know, developing 20 phones, they just focus on one. Talk to us a little bit about focus and why that's so important.
Yeah, thank you. We think it's the first rule or the first law of execution. There's so much going on just in the day-to-day operation of anyone's life or of anyone's business that absent focus, you just get run over by all the distractions. And the reason it's so difficult, and again, this is sort of a, you know, what we think anyways is almost like basic human wiring. You have to fight because the tendency is you want to say yes to all the good ideas. And there's always more good ideas than there's capacity to execute. And one of the things that Apple is famous for was saying no, not just to bad ideas, but Apple would say no to good ideas so they could put energy behind the stuff that really matters. And it's easy to say, it's just really hard to do.
Yeah, I liked this. There's a picture. I think I'm going to cut this out or blow it up or something. But there's a picture of a framed quote on page 29 of your book. And you say that you believe leaders should have this quote permanently displayed in their offices. And that quote is, there will always be more good ideas than there is capacity to execute. So let's just talk a little bit about the principles of focus, leverage, engagement, and accountability. And the ideas you put in this book, you say, are not new ideas. They've been tried and tested many, many times. in fact, you just have heavily researched them. You have benefited from that, or they have disciplines have benefited from that research. And then you've taken them to a whole new level for today's world. So talk to us a little bit about how the idea for the book came together.
It's not the kind of book where you have a great idea and you expand on that idea. This is something that we've been beating the subject up for a decade, and it's a hard topic, you know, which is how do you execute a strategy or a plan that requires, you know, a change in human behavior. It requires people to be engaged. That's a hard thing. And so we were after the real, what are the root disciplines for getting that done? And so, you know, after 10 years of work, and we've gotten this thing to where it's as predictable as it is, it really was time to write the book. But we're running on the back end of the process rather than on the front end of the process. And there's a lot of people that have contributed to this work.
Well, you say this made me laugh. There's good news and bad news. The good news is there are rules, and the bad news is that there are rules. But I want to just say that you noted the four disciplines are sequential and interdependent and must be done in order and done well to achieve breakthrough results. So let's take a quick look at what those four disciplines are. And we kind of touched a little on the first one, but talk about what you call wig versus whirlwind, if you would.
Yeah, so let's think of it this way. Put it in the context of creating a game, right? So, you know, 10 years worth of work, you know, guys, what did you learn? And we'd say, if you can turn your most critical priority into a game, you're well on your way. And that's so, you know, it sounds so simplistic, but it's not. It's kind of profound. And so if you look at the four rules as sort of a blueprint for creating a game, and the first, you know, and when you start to create a game, the first thing you got to do is you got to identify the finish line. How do you win at this game? And that's the first discipline. And the second discipline is this discipline of leverage. We call it act on the lead measures. So what are the critical? You know, if the game was losing weight, then the lead measures would be calories in and calories out, right? And no matter what the result is, there's always these key leading indicators where most of the leverage is. And discipline two is all about, it teaches people how to identify what does diet and exercise look like for this goal. Right? And
right.
That's the second of the disciplines. And once you have the first and the second discipline, you sort of have the skeleton for a game, but it hasn't taken shape yet. The third discipline, create a compelling scoreboard, is how you capture the game. And that's what we find is if people don't know the score, they've already disengaged.
Yeah.
The distractions and the competition of real work is so intense that they check out. And so you have to get it, not like the scoreboard, you know, not like the data we're used to seeing in organizations on spreadsheets and analysis. No, simple, like you would see at a sporting event.
Yeah.
Our lead measure and our lag measure, you know, are we winning or losing right now? And then it feels like it's something I can affect, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so by the time you get to discipline four, now that's how you play the game. And that's the team every week saying, all right, what can I do this week to have an impact on that scoreboard? You know, and things change week to week. So the commitments change week to week. But after a few weeks, the team starts to see that they're winning, and you get people that start to care about a business and about an operation and maybe something that they haven't really cared about before because they're playing a winnable game. And so at the end of the day, we found that, hey, you know, what we created here was a template for, you know, not only creating a winnable game, but getting people engaged.
Right. You say that it's so important that people keep track of their own scoreboard. Why is that?
Well, think of it this way. If you're in a park, you're never going to have a group of kids come up to you and say, oh, ma'am, can you help us out? We keep losing track of the score.
Right.
They know the score.
Right.
And the moral there is, look, if the people don't know the score, you probably already lost. And so we say, okay, the leader might be the one to post the scoreboard. You might, the team hopefully created the scoreboard. But the real question is the team keeping score? So at any point, if you catch somebody at a lunch break or after work, or, you know, how are we doing? And, you know, every leaders like to say, oh, I'm good on this one. I'm good on discipline three. Ask your people, because then it's going to tell you, is it the player's game or is it my game as the leader? And you don't want it to just be your game as the leader.
Right. And I think it's important to say that all of these, the four disciplines go right across the board through work, environments, and through home environments. I could see people applying these same principles to their kids and to their own projects, to their own lives.
We get this all the time. We wrote it for leaders, right? And, you know, and people have, you know, most people have some leadership responsibility somewhere in their life, right?
Right.
But it's so interesting how many people just come to us and say, you know, I had this goal. And we didn't do it deliberately, but people are using it. People use it everywhere.
Yeah, well, I've actually been told by people, oh, I just don't like business books. And I'm like, but why? Because there's so much. I apply business principles sometimes to my dog. You know, the principles are the same.
There you go. You just said it. They're principles. That's why it took us 10 years. There were a lot of good practices for execution, but we were after the root principles.
Yeah, and I want to talk, you talk about the magic of accountability being in the cadence, and that's in Discipline 4. Tell us what you mean by cadence and why that is so important in accountability.
Well, it's like a rhythm. And the week seems to be a very ideal time for this cadence. That every week, and we say the same time, the same day, every week at 2 o'clock, or Tuesday at 2 o'clock, that's when this meeting is going to be held. And, you know, we have some great, you know, the Department of Social Services for the state of Georgia recorded a 60% reduction in repeat cases of child maltreatment. Huge statewide goal. And they were zealots for this methodology. And you listen to the commissioner, you listen to her talk about this, and what she says is, we actually have this video on the website, but she says it's the cadence that works. She said, you know, last week we had a meeting, next week we're going to have a meeting. And they just stayed on focus every week. What can we do to impact the lead measures? And it's not like a strategic plan or a big, long plan that you create. You just set this week, I can see a week of time. I'm just going to do this one thing this week to move the score ahead.
Yeah.
And if you stay on that week by week, we see teams just do extraordinary things.
And I think a key thing that you said in the book is that this way the plan adapts as fast as the business changes. And that's such a key issue because some people get locked down on their plan and it becomes out of date, but they never update it.
Yep. And then they collect shit. Either right. Either the plan becomes irrelevant or it just collects dust on the shelf.
Right.
And real life's a lot more adaptive than that. It's moving.
Right. I also like the fact that, you know, you said having the team set their own commitments, having individuals set their own commitments goes way beyond job performance. It becomes a promise to the rest of the team.
Well, this was another happy accident. We had the, you know, early on as we were experimenting with this, we'd have the players set the commitments. And then you realized very quickly two things. First, you knew as the boss instantly whether the team knew how to play the game or not. If you're barking out orders, you don't really know if they know how to play the game. But if they're making the commitment, the leader gets whether they... So that was the first happy accident. The second happy accident was when they make a commitment in front of their other teammates, and it's them that makes the commitment, they don't want to break a commitment to their teammates.
Right.
They don't
right.
like disappointing the boss, but they'll do almost anything not to break a commitment to their peers. It's really interesting. So you get this really strong, this stuff actually gets done.
Yeah.
Despite the world.
A lot of power. A lot of power in peer pressure. So,
no kidding. We're harnessing a little of that.
Give me an example, Chris, if you would, of where playing this game you call the four disciplines of execution has helped you in your personal life.
Oh, that's a great one. I have seven children. somebody said the other day, they said, sounds like all execution and no discipline.
And yeah, okay,
and
so
you... but I have, so 20, the oldest is 20, and she's in London right now. I hear your accent right now. I don't know if it's English or...
Yeah, it's English.
Yeah, she's in London right now. I've got my littlest one is 2. But I had a lot in school in between. And so one of the things, and McChesney's are not good students. You know, I passed on some horrible genetics to my kids. And one of the things, I'm sad to say, right? But buy my book, right? No. But one of the things we've learned is that my wife and I have really applied this around two lead measures for school, which are what's Mariah's current homework average, and how many hours did she spend last week studying for exams outside of assignments? And those two lead measures, the lag measure we automatically get, but the scoreboarding of those two, Mariah, Aaron, and Ben, they're like in the high school, junior high age, it's become a winnable game. And it's had a huge impact, not only on their grades, but on the quality of life in the family. So,
well, I can see that.
Yeah, it's very personally applicable.
Yeah, I think it's a great book and some great disciplines in there. Certainly, I will be adapting them. And I've enjoyed playing with you for these 15 minutes. So I thank you for your time, Chris McChesney.
Likewise. Great questions. Thank you so much.
And if you want to find out more, the website is The Four Disciplines of Execution. That's the number 4disciplinesofexecution.com. We'll be back with another edition of Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair next week. Be sure and tune in.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.